want your soul.
Ever had a fear of monsters under your bed? Like you could have sworn you saw what seemed to be a shadow moving down there? Or freaked out when you heard a noise under the bed and was scared to look? I don't expect anybody to believe me on this, nor do I care anymore. I've told this to anyone and everyone I've ever known, but none believed. Not even my best friend. Not even the therapist. At this point, I've given up. And just tell this for a scary story to my friends, and would like to show it to the world. For the record, yes, this has actually happened to me. Believe it if you want to, or don't. It started back when I was about 6 years old. My family had moved to a new house in a new neighborhood, but still close enough to my friends. I still slept with my parents at that age, and was horribly scared to sleep alone. On restless nights, I had a habit of looking at the closet, seeing the clothes hanged and imagining the silhouettes of those clothes forming into monsters. Sometimes it looked like dark eyes watching me, sometimes just scary shadows. I would think anything was scary at night. When we got to the small house, my mom looked back at me from her seat in the car and told me I had to sleep alone from now on. I begged and I pleaded for her to continue sleeping with them, but no use. Their decision was made. From that age on, I was forced to sleep alone. I played outside with my toys while they put the furniture inside. As the sun got lower and the day started to turn to night, a strange fear crept into my body. I kept looking at the sunset, silently begging for it to stay up, when my mom called me in for dinner. As soon as I finished with dinner, my mother told me to go to sleep because I had school the next day. They went to bed as well, shortly after me. I closed my room door tight, closed all the windows and closet, and tried to go to sleep. It took me a while, but eventually I dozed off, only to be awakened a few minutes later by the sound of tapping. At first I thought it was my mom knocking at the door, but realized it came from under my bed. Random taps, not in any pattern or anything. It sounded like someone with long fingernails was tapping on the wood right below my upper back. When I finally fully woke up and began to realize that someone or something was tapping below my bed, it stopped. I believed that it was just something of my imagination and went back to sleep, but I was awoken again a few hours later by the same tapping. Again, as soon as whatever was under there saw that I had awoken, it stopped. I resumed my sleeping, only believing it was just my imagination. I awoke the next morning, still feeling tired. I went to school, got home, ate dinner, and went to sleep again, a little less scared by sleeping alone, only a little. Just like last time, the tapping woke me up, only this time I didn't ignore it, because it didn't stop like last time. It just continued. A small tapping right underneath my back. Then it changed to something that sent shivers down every inch of my body. It changed to a sound like, as if it was running its fingernails along the wood, scratching, sort of. I could almost feel the vibrations going from the left side of my shoulder to the right. It was terrifying. I didn't dare move or make a noise. I even slowed my breathing. This noise continued for minutes, hours. I couldn't go to sleep with that horrible tapping and scratching below my bed. Then the noise grew louder. It grew from a tapping to a knocking. Then from a knocking to a large banging. I panicked and screamed for my parents, and they came rushing in. My dad had a baseball bat. They asked what had happened. I told them I had heard a noise from my bed. They looked under it, but of course nothing was there. My mom told me to go back to bed, and I reluctantly did. The wave of fear once again crept over me as she turned out the lights. A few minutes after they had left, I turned the lights on and checked under the bed myself. A bold move for a six-year-old, but nothing. But once I checked the boards, there were deep-edged scratch marks on it. I immediately ran to my parents' room and asked to sleep with them, and they let me. The next few days, I slept with them until they decided I was comfortable enough to go back to my room. I begged them to let me continue sleeping with them, but they didn't budge. I stayed awake the entire night. and the tapping never started. At school, I fell asleep almost the entire time. This went on for about a week, until my teacher called my mom asking if I was sleeping well. My mom eventually found out I wasn't sleeping and grounded me. Eventually, I started sleeping again. That's when the tapping started once again, too. Every single day, I was awoken with this terrible tapping and scratching. Days turned into weeks, and weeks into months. I could no longer concentrate in school, and my grades were terrible. One particular night, however, was different. I entered my room and went to sleep. As always, the tapping woke me up after an hour or so. Except this time, it was on the side of the bed where my feet were. I rubbed my eyes. I waited a bit for my eyes to accustom to the dark. And when they did, I saw the most horrible thing I have ever seen in my life, sitting right beside my feet. Its back was towards me, and its hand was tapping the bed. It was sitting on the edge of my own bed. It looked somewhat like a hairless cat, except it was a humanoid. It had no hair anywhere on its body or head. Its hands were full of veins, and it had a huge, slightly broken fingernail. It looked like it could tear anyone's skin off completely, especially mine. The body was like an old man's body, wrinkly and old. That thing looked like it hadn't eaten in forever. I was terrified, in shock. After a few seconds, it began turning its back and head towards me. It had no eyes. Its skin covered the eye sockets and its mouth completely, like a puppet. The nose wasn't there either. Even though it had no eyes, it seemed to focus only on me. It radiated an emotion, sadness. It was as if it wanted me to give myself to it so he could eat me, satisfying its hunger and taking away its sadness. For some reason, I was tempted. I was in a trance, but I quickly snapped out of it and passed out from so much fear. The next morning, I awoke and immediately told my mom we had to move out. I screamed, cried, and begged until she was finally convinced something was bothering me and told my dad we had to leave. So we did. Fast forward to 3 years later. I now lived in a neighborhood far away from before. The image of that thing still haunted my memories and my nightmares, but I had never seen it again since that night. I had never told my friends or family what happened again, because they never believed me. My little sister had been born only a few months ago. Her name was Julie. She always slept with my parents, and I was a bit jealous. I was still afraid of sleeping alone due to what happened. My friends were always making fun of me because of it. One day, my best friend Zach invited me over to sleep at his house. I was very excited to go, until I got to his house. He had recently moved to the house that I used to live in. As I got my backpack full of stuff out of my mom's car, a wave of fear crept over my body when I turned around to see the old house that I once lived in and almost died in. I walked up to the wooden door to see my friend, opening it and greeting me with a large smile. "Took you long enough," he said. "Yeah, sorry. This is your house?" I said silently, hoping it wasn't. "Of course it is. Who else would it be, you idiot? Now come on in, let's see my new house," said Zach. I was hesitant to go in, but there was no turning back now. I entered and looked back to my friend, closing the door behind him. I didn't tell him I had once lived out of it. Once again, fear of that beast hearing me. The whole day I wouldn't feel comfortable staying in the house when it would always suggest we go outside and play ball. He suggested we play with his new video game, but I always said I didn't like playing games, even though I did. Finally, we were playing soccer in the front lawn. Zach's mom told us it was time to go inside and eat dinner, and soon after, go to sleep. My heart stopped. I looked out onto the night sky and realized I hadn't even seen the day go by. It went so fast, I wished it hadn't. As I was eating, all I could think about were the thing's eyes, or eye sockets. Even so, I had always been certain it was looking right at me that night it appeared, its whole face covered in its own skin. Almost like it was suffocate under it, but it could breathe fine, I thought. Maybe it was all a dream, I thought, but no, it was too real to be a dream. Dreams are usually like watching TV with a bad signal. Poor image and lots of static. An illusion, maybe. I thought to myself, was it all an illusion? It could have been. What with all the fears I had when I was smaller, but even then I was skeptical. Time to go to bed, kids. Hurry up now, Zach's mom said to us. Zach had two beds. His was on the left corner of the room and mine was right beside. I lay down on my bed and looked at the ceiling as Zach almost instantly fell asleep. I was scared. No, I was terrified. I think I spent about an hour and a half awake before I finally caught some sleep. Once I did, I started to dream about that thing. In my dream, I was waking up in my bed after hearing some tapping, as usual. I opened my eyes and saw nothing, though the tapping continued. For some unknown reason, I was somehow more brave than in real life and decided to look underneath my bed. What I saw made my heart want to die. Under my bed, slowly turning his bald head towards me, was what I thought was the monster, but was actually Zach. Zach, though, wasn't bald. He had hair in real life, though in my dream he... I stopped my thinking. This thing was literally wearing my best friend's face on his own. Even as a 9-year-old kid, I knew it was pretty much impossible for you to wear someone else's faces on your own, but this monster did just that. For the first time I saw this thing, it smiled at me. He was smiling, a big toothless grin, and stared down at me for what seemed like an eternity. He then lashed his hand out to me and instantly pierced my heart. I woke up, trying to scream but to no success. What I saw kept my scream lodged inside my throat. On top of me was him, staring down, making what seemed like a smile, or at least trying to make one, though he had no mouth. When he saw that I had woken up, he quickly scurried out of my room, bumping into the walls. I tried to take a look to see where he was going, but he went out of my sight and I was too terrified to get out of bed. Zach, however, was right beside me, sleeping peacefully. I tried to wake him up, but he wouldn't budge. He slept like a rock, so I stayed there awake for the rest of the night. I felt like I was alone, even though Zach was right there. Around 6 a.m., I heard Zach's parents getting up and I immediately opened the door and ran to them, begging them to take me home. They asked why, and I tried to tell them about the monster that tried to kill me, though as expected, they didn't believe anything I said. I begged and cried until they finally took me home. While I was in their car, I couldn't stop wondering where that thing might have gone to. 10 years passed by. I was in college and I was in my car driving towards my mom's house for the holidays. Dad had passed away and it was my sister's 10th birthday. At one point, I looked down at her present in the passenger seat next to me. I was going to give her what she had always wanted, the new doll that had come out a few weeks ago. The commercial showed that it would walk and talk by itself. Strange thing for a doll to do, but my sister would love it. As I neared my mother's house, I noticed the growing amount of parked cars. I thought to myself, this must be a huge party for a 10-year-old. I finally found a place to park my car and grabbed the doll, got out of my car and made my way to the house. My mom's eyes lit up when she saw me and she ran towards me to give me a big hug. She then ran back to the house to call my sister so I could give her my present. As expected, she loved it and immediately showed all her little friends. Unlike me, my sister was quite the popular girl in school. I guess she didn't inherit mom's shyness like I did. My whole life I was shy and introverted. As the party went on, I chatted with the adults as the kids ran around the house playing with their toys. Somehow, the subject of the conversation shifted to something that instantly brought chills down my spine. The parents began talking about a certain kid who had died about 3 years ago. In the same house, I nearly died in 10 years ago. The memories brought pain to my head and I told the parents I needed to go to the room I was sleeping in to lay down for a bit. I opened the door and lay down on the bed to see if it might get better. As I looked to the ceiling, the memory of that night kept replaying in my head over and over and over again until I closed my eyes and fell asleep. I don't remember exactly what I had dreamed about that night, but I awoke to silence, except for a familiar sound that, along with bringing fear into my body, also brought hatred, a hatred I seemed to have bottled up inside of me for more than 13 years. Almost instinctively, I looked under my bed instead of staying still like I usually would have done, and my heart stopped. Almost touching my face was his, looking me in the eye. His leathery skin covering his face was merely an inch from mine. From that moment, everything was silent, and by everything, I mean everything. There was not a single sound, no cars passing by, no humming of the refrigerator in the kitchen. From there, it was a blur. All I remember was him clumsily running out of my room and going in the direction of my mother's room, where she and my sister were sleeping. Things only became clear when I suddenly found myself hunched over my mom and sister. I looked around, but no monster. As my eyes wandered back towards my mom, all I began to see was blood and guts. The skin off her face was completely torn off, and the same happened to my sister. They both seemed to stare at me with their lidless eyes. I stood still. I couldn't even cry, and my heart was racing. As I began to panic, I felt a heavy breathing down my neck, and suddenly, a smack to my head knocked me out completely. I woke up tired and dizzy. The back of my head still hurt, and everything was still blurry. As things began to clear and I got up from my dirty, slightly bloodstained bed, I noticed metal bars to my right. Immediately, I ran up to see them to see what was going on. All I heard were crazy, deranged screams all around me. "Who's there?" I said in the darkness. All around me, I began to hear small giggles coming from the inside of cells. Then the screams began again. I waited for a bit, and waited, and waited. After what seemed like a few hours, dozens of lights turned on and a door on the right end of the hallway opened. I ran up to the metal bars and tried to see who it was. After a few moments, a bald, bearded man in a lab coat came into sight. He walked all the way around my cell and stopped, turned around me with a key in his hand and told me to follow him. He escorted me towards where he came from as a bunch of hands tried to touch us. A few had nails that were long and sharp, others had chunks of skin ripped off their fingers, some had both. The guy with the lab coat took me to a normal-looking room and calmly told me to have a seat at the table in the middle. He took a seat in front of me. "So tell me, from beginning to end, Mr. Richards, what exactly happened to you?" He handed me a notebook to write what happened in my cell, a present from him to pass the time. "For about a week, I've been writing. During that week, I've had numerous appointments with therapists. They all tell me the same thing, that all that happened to me was an illusion of my mind, and that basically it led me to murder my mom and sister. They told me the name of a condition I have, but I've already forgotten. Doesn't matter anyways, it's all nonsense. After a few days, I realized I was in a mental institution for crazy people. They let me call someone and I decided to call Zach. Not even he believed me. No one did. They don't want to help me or us. They just want us to lose our minds and rot in this place, like most of the prisoners in here. But I know he's still out there. He still wants me. He visited me tonight. I woke up in the middle of the night, and there he was, sitting at the end of my bed, facing away from me. I didn't do anything. I just watched him. He turned towards me, and I saw my mother's face, staring at me with a happy, psychopathic smile. The West Side Bank has three exits, 30 windows, and 19 air vents. And when I arrived at the scene, there were 13 people being held captive by a man with a vendetta. "How bad are things?" I asked the officer in charge. So far, no one had been hurt, but I knew that would change quickly if I didn't start talking to this terrorist. "The task force is small. Stuff like this doesn't happen every day to them, and I can tell they are scared." I sat down, placed the headpiece on, and tuned on the mic to chat with this psychopath. "To whom am I speaking?" My voice was calm and firm. I wanted to show that I was ready to talk as long as necessary. "To whom am I speaking?" It was a man's voice. He sounded older. There was a nervous and emotional edge to the way he spoke. He was unsure about how this was going to play out. "Special Agent Dennis Lassiter," I replied back. Another pause. "Have you done this for long, Special Agent Dennis Lassiter?" he quipped. There was a bit more confidence in his voice this time. "7 years. How about you?" I wanted to show this guy I was ready to tangle. "No, never. But there's a first time for everything, isn't there, Special Agent Dennis Lassiter?" "Well, there doesn't have to be. After all, we're talking right now just fine, so I think we can come to some sort of an agreement, I told him. This was basic procedure. Actively listen, find out what he wanted. Then there was a longer pause. You married Dennis? That took me by surprise. I hadn't heard from Kristen in a while. Things had become strained. I'm divorced. You? I kept my voice steady. I wanted him to get comfortable with me. Same. Wasn't my choice, really. Job never can make ends meet, if you know what I mean. Now we were getting somewhere. That sounds difficult, stressful. I can imagine it would only make sense for you to do what you are doing, I said. I needed to build rapport, get him to trust me. Everything fell into place when Michael died, he explained. From the way his voice cracked, I could tell that that had to be his son. Oh, how old was he? I said. 5, he said. It was a car accident that took him from me. After that, life just had no meaning anymore. I've always wanted a son, he said. He was in pain, and I understood it. It sounds like you've been planning this for quite a while now, I said. 4 years, but it was mostly a waiting game, he said, because I remembered every single detail. Just had to make it count, make it work. Now he was rambling on. I tried to steer him back on course. Well, we can make things go your way, sir, I said. Everyone can walk away from this alive today. If I play my cards right, yeah, he said. I know how this works. I relaxed a little. He was actually calming down. And so I went on. I know that you think this will somehow balance out all the pain that you have had to go through in your life, but it won't. It won't bring your son back, I explained. Another very long pause. He was thinking over what to do. Then he said, what if I told you it could? This time it was my turn to hesitate. I didn't know how to respond to that. He went further. If it could bring back someone I love, do you think it would be worth it? He said. I swallowed. His speech had conviction, like he was sure of this. He believed what he was saying could possibly be true. Yeah, sure, of course, I said. It would be a miracle. A once-in-a-lifetime shot to change things. Anyone would take that risk, right? He said. Now his voice was shaky again. He needed to convince me. There must be another way, sir, I told him softly. Not one that I can see, he said. Trust me, I've tried. I've thought long and hard about this moment for years, Special Agent, to think of a way out. But there isn't, he said. But you have to succeed, so tell me what you need. We can make it happen, I said. I could tell that he was slipping, pulling away, that we were losing that connection. I needed to reinforce that I was his only shot. It isn't about me, he said. It's about you, Dennis, and what you need. He went on. That struck me as an odd thing to say, but I tried to stay in tune with what he was getting at. Okay, sure. I can do whatever you need. Just say the word, I said. It's a bit long. Do you have a pen and paper? He asked. I can remember. Go ahead, I said. You're going to want to write this down, Special Agent Dennis. I shuffled my papers and found one. Okay, I'm ready, I said. Tomorrow morning, you're going to go down to the coffee shop like you always do. You're going to order your favorite brand of mocha and talk about the weather to that cute barista. Her name is Lucy. You two have actually made small talk before. She's going to ask you if you have the time. You have to tell her no, Dennis. You have to get up, walk away, and leave immediately. I felt a nervous sense of unease in the back of my head. How did he know so much about my daily routine? And so I said, okay, sir, that's an odd, specific request, but that's fine. I will do that. You mustn't talk to her, Dennis, he said. You must leave immediately and cross the street to buy a lotto ticket. 6542-1523. Repeat that to me, he said. I did, but I didn't even understand what was going on. And Dennis, one other thing, he said. I was hanging on his words now, trying to figure this man out. Everything about this conversation had changed in less than a few seconds. You need to tell Kristen that you love her, he said. My mouth went dry. I heard the discharge of a gun. The SWAT team immediately moved in. I stood up, my palms sweaty. I raced to the front entrance of the bank. The hostages were running out, shrieking and crying as they embraced family. Media swarmed in to try to get a glimpse of the killer, but the bullet had been precise. He had blown his head completely off. I stood there looking over his bloody body, confused and frightened by his words. I looked down at his index finger, saw a familiar scarring on it, and felt a shiver run down my spine. I had a scar there, in the same exact spot. It was from my second tour in Afghanistan, and a tattoo right next to it of the day it happened. They were the same. I left the scene immediately, nerve shot and confused. This had to have been an elaborate hoax, but who would do this to me? However, the next morning, I intended to do exactly as instructed, to the letter, even that damned lotto number. And I did exactly that. A few moments after I got the lotto ticket, the cashier congratulated me. I had won the scratch-off. What are the odds? The cashier said excitedly. Astronomical, I realized. A once-in-a-lifetime miracle. As I stood there and gazed at the ticket, something flashed before my eyes. Another life. A life I didn't live. I saw myself talking more to the barista, dating her, telling her I wanted to marry her. The life was good. We had a son, and we were happy. Then it was dashed to pieces. I saw the crash that took his life. The glass impaled his young body against the side as the vehicle was crushed. I saw my wife spiral into depression and then take her own life later that year, slicing her wrists in the bathroom and waiting for me to find her cold and alone. I saw the impossible abyss about to swallow me whole, take me under it until it never stopped strangling every last ounce of hope from my body. And then the moment was gone. I was back in the cashier's stand and staring at the ticket again. I took out my phone and called the office in charge. Hey, Chief, sorry to bother you, but did you get an ID back on that body? Body, he said. What are you talking about? The heist. What happened to the kidnapper? I said. Dennis, I don't know what you're talking about. What heist? He said. My mouth went dry. I felt my phone vibrate. Another call was coming in. Lassiter, is everything okay? He said. I checked the caller ID. It was Kristen. Tears welled up in my eyes. Yeah, everything is fine. I'll call you later. Back when I was about 18 or 19, I used to work at a gas station. It was a little out-of-the-way spot, which consisted of two tiny rooms. The first room you came into as you entered was the store area. It was basically a small room with enough space for a register area and counter, with some gum and some candy bars on it and a few coolers with drinks. It really was just a gas station. Not one of those big, all-in-one, fancy-pants types of joints. As you walked into the store area, there was a little entry hall with chips and such on neither side. You'd then take a few steps and make it into the left of the store. After you made the left, on the right were the coolers which lined the wall all the way to the end for about 15 feet. On the left was the register area and counter, and directly ahead of you was the door into the back office. The back office was just a primitive square little room with cement walls and floors. The ceiling wasn't tiled like the rest of the store, so if you wanted to, you could stand on the desk in the office and look over the wall into the store area. With the exception of the wall in front of the desk, which was drywall and held a tack board, all the gray stone walls were bare, and the room was barely lit. I don't like going back in there to do my paperwork. It was a very gray, depressing, and quite frankly, a little claustrophobic, scary room. So, one night I was working the night shift, like I do now. I've had several night shift jobs over the years, so this is not new to me. I'm pretty much a night person, and I'm always up late, so it just seems to make sense. Anyway, this night was cold and rainy. Very lonely out there, like most nights. I'd had a regular customer come in the store, Jim, a fellow night shifter, just getting some coffee and having a chat before he headed off to work. He put down the money for his coffee and told me to keep the change and then ran out into the rain. The door made that horrible ding noise as he opened it and was accompanied by a clap of thunder and the sound of rain beating on the pavement outside. The way the store was set up, I couldn't see out the window, so I turned towards the security monitor and watched Jim run across the lot to his truck underneath the roof at the gas pumps. I laughed to myself in my warm, dry, and cozy little den as he got stuck in his truck, started it, and pulled off into the night. As the truck pulled away, it revealed the man that must have been hidden behind it. He was just standing there under the roof of the gas pumps, facing in the direction of the camera. Jim's truck came back onto the camera in the background as he turned around and pulled out onto the road, leaving me behind with this strange man. The man stood there for a long while, looking up at the camera, at me. I couldn't really make out any features, as he was towards the far end of the pumps, just visible between pumps 3 and 4 and 7 and 8. It was really unnerving just watching him there, standing still, not moving. After a while, I just decided that he was trying to get out of the rain, and while I still found it odd, I turned my attention back to a good scary book that I had been reading. Probably about 20 minutes had passed, and I had nearly forgotten about him, when a loud crack of thunder snapped me out of my book and back to reality. I nearly jumped out of my chair. I sighed, trying to calm myself, but then I turned towards the monitor and my heart rate picked back up. The man was still out there. Only now he was much closer, standing in the rain. I could now tell that he was definitely looking at the camera, almost as if he could see me watching him. He had a sinister smile on his face that just peeked out from underneath the hood that covered his head. He had on a black jacket and jeans and held something in his right hand. It glinted in the light from the store, which he now stood only about 20 feet away from. My throat began to swell up like it does often in moments of intense fear. I didn't like this at all. I had to lock the door. Even though the man hadn't done anything overly threatening, it was clear that something was wrong here. Nobody normal stands in a thunderstorm glaring intently at a gas station security camera with a creepy smile on their face and a shiny metal object in their hand. I slowly stepped around the counter and dropped down to the floor. I was scared and I didn't want this freak to see me. If he saw me going to the door, it might cause him to spring into action, whatever dreadful action that may be. So once on the floor, I crawled towards the entry hall and peeked around the corner. He would probably be able to see me when I got to the door, so I'd have to be quick about locking it. I got the keys from my pocket and slowly crawled towards the door. When I got to a spot where I should be able to see the man, I took it slowly, inch by inch, as not to be seen. But he wasn't there. Every measured advancement revealed nothing in the lot. After I was sure I didn't see him, I reached up with my keys, quickly locked the door, and retreated back into the store. As I came back up on the check register area, I looked at the monitor and he was still there, in the same spot, looking directly at me. Only now he had his right hand out in front of him, and I could clearly see the knife he had clutched in it. That wicked smile spread even further across his face until it was just a gash splitting open the darkness under his hood, glimmering in the light. It was like he knew I had now seen the knife and was mocking me. Never have I felt such terror. Such a sense that I was about to die. This man knew I was in there, and he had planned to murder me. I grabbed my book bag and backpedaled from behind the check register, threw open the back office door, and slammed it shut behind me. I made sure the door was locked, tossed my bag on the desk, and sat down to use the phone. I dialed 911 right away. On my right, there was more security monitors. Those ones had various angles, including the interior, so the manager could watch the employees and whatnot. The man was nowhere to be seen on any of the screens. The 911 operator then answered, and I bumbled my words, trying hurriedly to explain the situation. Eventually, I got her to understand that there was a knife-wielding maniac somewhere on the property. She told me to remain calm and that police were on their way. She said she would stay on the line with me. However, only seconds after she said it, there was a loud bang of thunder followed by a low droning sound like an engine winding down. Then, in the blink of an eye, all the light was stolen from the room as the building shuttered and the power died. I sat in silence, listening, hoping that the phone hadn't died. I waited for the operator to say something, afraid to speak myself and see if she was still there. But she wasn't. As soon as the room descended into darkness, I felt like the man was everywhere. Right behind me, right in front of me. Every movement was nerve-wracking, every sound thunderous, every thunderclap cataclysmic. Slowly, I slid under the desk, pulling my bag underneath me. It held a small bat, a little good it would do to me in this darkness. I sat there in silence forever, listening to the rain beat on the roof and the gentle rumble of thunder as the storm slowly moved away. A deadly silence ensued, and I thought I could hear something, maybe footsteps. I could definitely hear something that sounded a lot like shuffling feet, but couldn't tell where it was coming from. Maybe it was outside or out in the store. Hey, maybe it's the cops, I realized suddenly, and the thought lit me up like a Christmas tree. Still, I didn't want to risk moving. The shuffling had stopped now, but in its wake, the building let out a groan and again began to shudder. The lights surged back to life. Machines beeped and clicked and whirred in unison, as if surprised by being suddenly exposed in the light. I was hesitant, but I carefully peeked my head out to look at the monitors. They were still off, so I crawled out and hit on the switch on one of them. The monitor blinked on and slowly began to reveal a black and white image. It was the man. He was back. He was now standing inside the store. In his right hand, the knife was smeared with a dark liquid. It dripped onto the floor, melding with the rest of the black liquid pooled at the man's feet. He stared up at the camera with that jagged black smile. Blood dripped from his lips and was smeared on his chin. He was just on the other side of that thin wall. I don't know what it was that drove me to this next act. Probably just pure stupidity from my brain being fried by the horrors of the night. Briskly, and in my state of mind, I climbed up atop the desk with the intention of looking over the wall and into the store on the other side. I wasn't tall enough, however, and so with my feet, I kicked a couple of books against the wall and stood on them. Before looking over, I glanced down towards the monitor. Once again, the man had disappeared, along with any sign of the demented image the monitor had showed me before. With a sigh, I turned my head to look over into the store. And there he was, directly in front of me, only a foot away. I was face to face with his jagged, blood-stained smile. Only his face wasn't a face, and his smile wasn't a smile. The man's throat grinned at me from the other side of the wall, gashed open from ear to ear. His head was lolled back and mostly covered by the hood. He must have been floating there in the air on the other side of the wall, as there was nothing there for him to stand on. His throat gurgled and blood bubbled out of the gaping slice in his flesh. I could hear and see his breath as it left his body like a tire with a slow leak. I stumbled backwards, and the books kicked out from under me. I fell from the desk, and the room again sank into blackness. I woke up to an officer shining his flashlight in my face. "Are you all right, son?" And, "Call a medical unit," I heard someone say. My vision was kind of going in and out at the time, and for a moment I thought I saw the dead man behind the officer. I tried to jump up, but my head spun and I fell back almost immediately. "Whoa, easy, son," I heard the officer say. "I don't need another one of you dying on me here." I laid my head back down and closed my eyes, and everything spun away. Several days later, I was out of the hospital, and I went to the gas station to tell my boss that I wouldn't be back unless he'd put me on during the day, that is. But before I left, I had to ask him about what the cop had said about another one of you dying here. I didn't know what he meant by that. Turns out, he knew exactly what the cop had meant. Apparently, a few years before I'd started working for him, there was another night shift kid who supposedly went a little crazy. He started saying that he'd been seeing a man in the camera who wasn't really there, and some other nonsense. He eventually became extremely depressed. In the end, he slit his own throat right there in that little, lonely gas station. Now, every so often, on cold and rainy nights, I'll see that poor kid's throat gurgling up blood in my mind, gasping for air. And when I finally manage to snap out of it, I realize I've gone to the kitchen, and now I'm holding a knife. How well do you trust the exits and turnoffs that dot your local interstate highway? I tell this story to make you reconsider taking such detours. While driving through heavy rain on the Ohio Turnpike last year, I caught sight of a plain-looking sign during an upward battle with my eyelids to stay open. The word sleep was in the title. After what seemed to be just a few moments later, another brown sign, even rustier than before, came into view. Sleepy Trove Rest Stop, 1 mile ahead, it read. As I passed this second sign, I felt an intense numbing feeling drape over my whole body. I was tired and I couldn't deny it to myself any longer. I swerved and succeeded in pulling off at the exit. For a minute or more as I followed the dimly lit turnoff, the rain continued to pour down and I told myself I made the right decision. Looking back now, I tell myself that I would have turned off even if the rest stop name hadn't comprised the word sleep in the title, but I'm not convinced of that because not so subliminal advertising works well when you're completely exhausted. I had been driving home from college for a weekend break. I knew I needed a lazy weekend getaway and I was looking very much forward to my mom's cooking and crashing in my old bedroom. But I couldn't help that my thoughts, or rather my dreams about my bed, seemed to lead me to make my last second decision to pull off the road and follow the strange brown colored sign to the Sleepy Trove rest stop. I now wish I hadn't. Instead of the usual Turnpike Service Plaza, there was only a block of restrooms, lit solely by my headlights as I parked in the front. Mine was the only car to grace the cement structure, which was not too surprising because it was after midnight and maybe the more seasoned travelers had known the lack of Starbucks and McDonald's at Sleepy Trove. The absence of restaurant logos upon the rest stop sign should have been a warning to me, but as I say, I was very tired. At first I was relieved to be alone, but despite feeling somewhat safe, I locked my door before reclining my seat. With my vehicle engine off and the rain easing, I could now listen to a paranormal radio talkback show that seemed to be the only strong signal all night, besides my circadian rhythm telling me to pass out, that is. The guest on the radio program was talking about missing people all over the United States and how there were clusters of disappearances near national parks. I turned it off, not because I was getting scared or anything, but because the guest's final conclusion was that the perpetrator was in fact Bigfoot, which he annoyingly called Sasquatch to lend undue scientific sounding weight to his premise, and I found it rather annoying. As the rain dwindled away, the unmistakable heaviness in my bladder became harder and harder to ignore. That beer I shared at my buddy Dave's before I left was no doubt the culprit. The thing was, I didn't even like using those pretty bathrooms at Macy's, let alone this run-down, no doubt spider-infested trucker's dump. But since the rain had stopped and nobody else was around at that moment, I convinced myself that it was the best time to go. Unlocking the door, I dashed over to the men's entrance. Luckily, a single bulb hanging down from the cobweb ceiling lit the cubed, windowless room. There was an energy drink bottle in the single sink, a discarded hooded raincoat in the corner, and what I hoped was just rainwater soaking the yellow tiled floor. As I made use of the stainless steel urinal, the heavy downpour of rain began again like applauding angels. The roof was bombarded with water and the sound reverberated through the bathroom. Even through the rain, I still couldn't mistake the sound of my car's engine starting up. I zipped up and bolted to the entrance, stumbling over just in time to see my taillights speed away back towards the interstate before vanishing in the watery curtain of the blasted storm. I stepped back into the restroom, now freaking out and checking my pockets and realizing that I had indeed left my keys in the ignition. Someone must have been waiting in anticipation for me to finally get out of my car. Someone who had obviously gotten his courage from the energy drink in the sink. I cursed the Bigfoot man on the radio in anger for me causing to leave the keys in the ignition to listen to his dribble. But soon relief washed over as I pulled out my cell phone. At least I had that on me still. I would call the police and they could head the thief off with a roadblock and bring my car right back, I figured. But right away, I was back to cursing Dr. Sasquatch as soon as I saw there was no reception in this urine-soaked hellhole. It was then, as I was moving about the restroom trying to find a signal, that I first saw it. Well, I had of course noticed it earlier. The industrial blue hooded rain jacket plopped in the corner that had been there all along, but now out of the corner of my eye it shuffled ever so slightly. I stepped away, afraid there was a rat or something inside. Staring at the half-sitting up jacket, I realized something about it unnerved me. It was sprinkled with water, but was against the far wall where rain couldn't have possibly reached it. There was also something else that caused me to shiver. A rusty old chain was attached to the tiled wall, and metal links trailed up the jacket's sleeve. At that point, I noticed I had moved all the way to the door. Eerily, I stared at the strange-looking jacket as the bashing deluge upon the roof almost deafened my ears, and with that, my mind began panicking again. My heart felt like it was about to leap out of my chest. Having my back already drenched from the downpour, I made the decision to get away and try to find a signal on my phone, and to also think clearly away from the noisy ceiling. I first considered heading for the road and trying to flag down a car or truck, but knew they wouldn't see me on the rain-swept road. Instead, I circled around the back of the restroom block, using my phone as a light source and constantly checking the bars for reception. I tried to text a quick message to my friend Dave, stuck at Sleepy Cove rest stop on Turnpike, "Come help." I was so fixated at seeing a signal icon that my feet almost stepped into a lake that was down a slight hill from the restroom. Looking across the rather large lake, I could see what looked like little houses lit up against the night's darkness. After my eyes adjusted, I made out the houses that were on an island, and that they were not houses at all. The lights were coming from one facility. It was a collection of huts and cabins circled by a veranda, very much like a campground, and there was still no activity on my phone. I followed the lake for a few minutes until coming to an ancient, half-sunken, missing planked wharf. There was no corrugated iron sign that, when illuminated by my phone, read, "Sleepy Trove Boy Scout Camp." I immediately glanced back over to the set of cabins across the lake, but could see no sign of them anymore. I assumed trees or some other mass were blocking the lights from that position. Walking back the way I had come to recapture the previous view of the faraway campground, I quickly realized that all the lights must have been turned off. Had they seen me, or was it only a coincidence? Maybe the lights had been on a timer, or the storm had knocked the power out. As the rain soaked me to the bone, I worried about damaging my phone and I hurried back to the restroom block. This time I went into the ladies' side, and to my disappointment, it was no nicer than the men's. I then said a silent prayer to use and enjoy the Macy's bathroom if I ever got out of this place. As I clenched paper towels over my phone to dry it, I thought I saw one reception bar fleet across the top of the screen. I clicked on the connectivity option and was surprised to find a Wi-Fi connection. Tapping it so quickly that I almost splintered my screen, I joined the free Wi-Fi of Sleepy Trove Boy Scout Camp. The name unnerved me, as by the looks of that wharf, surely no Boy Scouts had been over to that little island since the dawn of the internet. The signal strength was weak, but my phone search engine popped right up. I had never been more curious, and since none of my friends, family, or Dave would be on Facebook this early, I typed in Sleepy Trove Boy Scout Camp. And the words like abandoned, haunted, trespass, disappearances, cults, cryptids, and urban exploration littered webpage descriptions. When I clicked on links, they failed to load, and so I gathered most of the information from the search results. Sleepy Trove Camp was apparently closed in 1982 after several boys had been violently disassembled by an unidentified hostile force. Their ghosts and the unidentified hostile force are said to badly haunt the area. Right as I read that bit of chilling information, the shared wall with the men's room that I had previously been in began banging. The source of the commotion originated from a rusty square panel about ankle height. Realizing that it was the backing to the chain that was attached to the jacket made me shudder. Someone or something was yanking on that chain like a game of tug of war. A blood-freezing scream then echoed from the neighboring restroom before the banging ended abruptly. I heard someone running outside, and when the heavy footsteps sounded like they were far enough away, I ventured out of the safe ladies' room and headed back to the men's, guided only by my light of my trusty phone. I remember passing by a newly arrived car before heading into the bathroom as my perceptions became a deafening, warpy blur. As I stepped into the men's bathroom again, fear and the worst sense of dread rushed over me as I laid eyes on a very dead figure slumped against the urinal. The grotesque, twisted body was that of my friend, Dave. It turned out that he had received my text after all. His face was contorted in an agonizing explosion of frozen terror. Blood now covered the urine-soaked tiles, and the jacket from the corner was now lying discarded by the door, covered in blood and large chunks of brown, dirty hair. The chain had been ripped out of the wall as well. Whoever or whatever had been trapped there had been awoken and was now free. The next thing I clearly remember is hearing my screams mixed with the sound of Dave's car horn as the fist beat the steering wheel. I've done little research since that horrifying night. My car was found just one stop down the turnpike. Traces of similar filthy brown hair were discovered on the driver's seat. The police said they were adult, whereas the hair from the restroom was from a child, both most likely that of a primate. I let my parents handle liaison with the police after that. I don't know what lights I saw over at Sleepy Trove Boy Scout camp that night, but I often imagine they lived there and traveled to the structures and facilities that dot the mainland to find their victims. Trespassing on the Boy Scout Camp Island can bring with it a $1,000 fine, but I wouldn't even go back if they paid me that much. It's not like I could return anyway. The Sleepy Trove exit is gone, and the restroom block has been torn down. Try searching for it online, or, heavens forbid, on the turnpike itself, and you won't find any trace of it. But I fear as we move further and further away from them, they will continue to encroach more and more upon us. As I said, do you trust those stops off the highway? I sure don't. They move again tonight. I lay and watch them, seeing as it's all I can do. They slip and slide through the street lamp, window curtain shaded lights, and I know my eyes have begun to fail. Or perhaps my eyes are fine, and my mind is finally going from the pain and boredom. Dying is a lonely business. The shadows dance me to sleep, and I dream again of Eileen. It starts out well, more relived memory than a dream. I see her bent over that diner counter, in a light pink poodle skirt, pointing to a slice of warm pecan pie, and I laugh a little. It sounds like my present-day laugh, a harsh, phlegm-filled bark, as the same old thought rolls through my head. What an ass on her. People act like we were all chaste and proper back then, but hormones never change. My domineering thought in those days was the best way to get her, or any girl for that matter, into the back seat of a 57 Chevy. She turns her curly carrot-colored hair, slipping down her shoulders, and I scream myself back awake. I cough up a lung and try to blink away the vision. Her face wasn't young and clean as it should have been, as it had been all those years ago. Instead, it was dark, ruddy, and rotted, as I imagine her to be now 6 feet down and moldering. The door opens and the creak sends a chill down what I can still feel of my spine. My breath stops, and I hold it. It is only Joan, my home hospice worker, and not dear dead Eileen that steps through. "Everything all right, Mr. Jenkins?" she asks. "Well," I mumble. God, when did my voice get so weak? I'm 79, my legs don't work, and it's quite possible I've crapped myself, so it's a resounding no, I said. She chuckles. I always could make the girls laugh. I'll check you, she says. Time for your meds anyways. Whoopee, I replied. Make it a double. Joan does her business of cleaning up my business, jabs a long, thick needle through the thin skin of my arm and disappears. I close my eyes, but sleep doesn't come this time. My eyes pry back open and I catch my breath. The shadows have moved again. I know, shadows move. I'm old, but not crazy. At least not yet. The darkness pools in the center of the ceiling. No light to cast them away. They stretch and form into a humanoid shape, tall and amorphous, like a thin man in a shroud. Like death, I realize. I wonder if this is it. If so, then break out the Sith. I'm too old to fear the Reaper anymore. No Sith comes. Instead, the figure cocks its head to the side like a confused child, then swirls into a ball again. I watch, confused as a child myself, as the shadows split. I realize a scene is taking form in silhouette. A flat, straight line of shadow runs across the ceiling. Other shadows rise from it, forming little more than stick figures, but people just the same. More and more lines move out and I smile. I know what I am seeing now, what the shadows form, even if it is just a drug or dying-induced hallucination. There was a ringmaster, top hat and all. He gestured to the right, to a lion in a caricature, a man with a whip made of darkness dancing before it. There was the trapeze, a stick man, or a stick woman, I suppose. I'm not sure of the sex of the shadows, flying through the air with the greatest of ease and cannons and clowns and little stick shadow monkeys and laughter like I hadn't heard in ages. The racking coughs come to remind me that all things, even laughter, require payment. The circus packed up as I wheezed, the cloak back, cocking its head again at a different angle, almost one of concern. The coughing wouldn't stop, the ache in my guts growing steadily worse from the strain as Joan threw open the door again, the light from the doorway causing the shadows to dart to the corner of the room. We never used the room light unless absolutely necessary. It hurt my eyes. She pulled me up into a sitting position and the coughing finally subsided. Thank you, I wheezed as she eased me back onto the bed. That's why I'm here, she said. Now you try and rest. I barely heard her. I was looking at the ceiling, at the shadows. The shadows encircled her head as she leaned over me, but there was no laughter now, no ringmaster. It had been replaced with a writhing monstrosity of ink-black tentacles around a gaping mouth filled with jagged shadow teeth. Centered in the mouth was Joan's plain face, mousy-haired head. I wheezed, no, as loud as I could, but it came out as nothing more than a whisper. The mouth then began to close. I had no idea if the shadows or whatever they were could hurt her, but I wouldn't let them if I could stop it. Joan just smiled and said, "You rest now," and turned to leave, undevoured. I concentrated on the shadows as she made her way across the room. They seemed to draw back from her presence, as if in fear, the monster turning to a cowering boy, its arm extended, pointing as if in accusation. I don't understand, I whispered. The ball of shadow roiled, a move that made me think of frustration, and did so until sleep finally took me over. I lay waiting for the day to pass, same as all days now, filled with hot broth and bad TV. But this day also held anticipation. I didn't know if I would see the shadows again, but I hoped, even if they were just the symptoms of an old, dying mind. Finally, the sunlight crept its way outside of the window, the only muted light left of the street lamp outside. I sighed and closed my eyes, waiting for something I was sure would never come. I dozed off a half hour or so before I opened my eyes again. The shadow ball shimmered on the ceiling. The shimmering seemed to grow more intense as I smiled up at it. Then it split, a new scene for a new night. A western this time, with stick figure saloon girls and dueling cowboys, even a stagecoach robbery. The shadows recoiled as the door opened, spilling a crack of light into the room. Joan entered, syringe in hand. She said something, but I didn't hear her. All my faculties were focused on the ceiling. The shadow swirled around her again, careful of the beam of light from the hallway. The monster was back, its mouth a silent roar aimed at Joan. Then the monster became the cloak of death, its silhouette head staring down at me. Two open spots of ceilings for eyes. The image shook, and I realized it was moving back and forth as if it was shaking its head no. A hand reached from the dark mass, skeletal in its thinness, and pointed at Joan, and at the syringe that slid effortlessly into my arm. What is that? I asked her. Just medicine, she replied. Just what the doctor ordered, she exclaimed. Sure, sure, I said, and watched her leave. As whatever it was coursed through my veins, I took a deep, rattling breath and let it all go. Dying is rough. Being dead, not so bad, to be honest. At least not here. I've heard talk of somewhere else, somewhere I never want to see. There are lots of things on this side, not just people, but things that have never roamed our world. Eileen is here, and the baby we lost so long ago. And there are things here that just like giving the dying a few moments of happiness, even if they're taken before their time, like I was. Though it's not easy to communicate with the other side, we can see and we can hear it all, if we want. As I watched Joan's trembling hands tie the noose, as the shadows on the walls around her cast reflections of horrid, sharp-toothed things, I realize I don't hate her. At least not for the arsenic she pumped into my blood. I was old and missed my wife. She probably did me a favor. That's not why the shadows and I did this. She was driven to this. See, I wasn't her first and I wouldn't be her last. Time is funny here. You can see it if you look hard enough. Even the future, possible ones anyways. And whether Joan had stayed in hospice or, like in so many futures, went into neonatal care, it was always the same. She had an agenda, and murder was on her mind. I wasn't her first, but now that I'm starting to think of it, I'm going to make damn sure that I'm her last.